Hello there, Verbal Shenanigans fans, listeners. When was the last time you had a real challenge in your fantasy sports league? Are you bored with the stale and mundane redraft league year after year? DynastySportsEmpire.com understands, and that's why they are the nation's leading dynasty league management company. Building a team from scratch is easy, but building a dynasty takes skill. Manage your roster with the same players, compete against the same teams, build fun, exciting rivalries for years. DynastySportsEmpire.com fantasy baseball season is heating up and leagues are now forming for the upcoming season. Visit them online at DynastySportsEmpire.com to start building your future franchise today. Must be 18 years or older to join. Rules may apply, but that is DynastySportsEmpire.com. We have a fantastic episode for you today. I'm excited to bring it to you, so strap on in.
Hey, this is Matthew O'Brien, author of the book Dark Days, Bright Nights. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Welcome on to another installment of Verbal Shenanigans. Scott here, and I've decided that let's call Mike on the fly and throw him right onto the show. Let's see if we can catch him off guard with something, see if we can catch him confused. Odds are it's going to happen. So let's give Mike a call here. Caller, you're on the line.
Yes, first time, long time.
Yes.
Is the secret word wubba dubba dub dub?
Close enough, close enough. You win tonight's co-hosting job. Welcome.
Oh,
welcome.
Man, I've been trying to get on this show for, when it comes to think, man, I never tried.
Yeah. So, hi, Mike. We decided just to, jump right in and call you and just catch you off guard, see if you were doing anything weird, see if you were wearing anything strange, see if we caught you in an awkward moment. But it seems it's the same old you. So, I guess my attempt didn't work.
Always prepared, man. I'm like a podcasting ninja. I'm just looking in the shadows, waiting for something to pop out. I'm like, I'm going to interview. I'm going to have a witty anecdote about that.
Yeah. That was my attempt of breaking up the intro that I love to do so much. You know that you always know that's my favorite part of the podcast is coming up with a new intro, and basically every week it starts with, "Hey everybody, welcome to another," and I usually say installment or another episode of Verbal Shenanigans, and it basically is the same intro every week.
Maybe we should do like that one Seinfeld episode and go in reverse. Like we'll
Berlew, anything to promote.
Yeah. And then just like go backwards and maybe even play the interview backwards to give it the authentic Seinfeldian vibe.
That's like the other day I was, when the baby's going to sleep, I try to play like white noise sometimes. And I go on the Spotify and I click and it's like, oh, the white noise podcast or something. I'm like, this can't be what I think it is. And sure enough, it clicks on. It's like, hey, guys, it's Jane from blah, 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 blah. And you're tuned into another episode of White Noise Podcast. And then I skip ahead like 30 seconds and it's just for like an hour. So someone has called it a podcast, has taken White Noise and called it a podcast and guarantee they have probably 10 times, 30 times more listeners than we do.
Yeah, she's making like six figures on Patreon. She's just raking it in like. YouTube is buzzing her ear and all. It's like you got to put this in a video, man. This thing is insane.
White Noise, let me see. Relaxing White Noise, the podcast. Okay, and let's see how many episodes they have. Oh, they got a it looks like they put one out every week, Berlew. Just so you know, last week they put out Cosmic Glow White Noise, 3 hours. Before that, last week was Rain and Ocean Waves. Before that was Airplane Turboprop. Sounds like a British, like a new wave band. Airplane Turboprop.
Like an off show and just played like foghorn sounds.
See, no, that would be a great prank. Like if we put out a white noise episode and just in the middle, it was like the loud, it's like awful, like hardcore techno that wakes the baby up immediately. That would be a good listen.
It's like those YouTube videos that has, I forget what they're, I think they're called jumpers, where it's just like, there's a tiny ghost, look for it somewhere in the middle, and then like somebody like zombie makeup comes out screaming, and you just go, bah!
Yeah, like jump scares or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I fell for a few of those in my day.
Yeah, I'm so super cautious about it. Like, even when like a friend sends something, I'm kind of like 2 minutes in the video, I'm like, I know it's coming.
Yeah,
I know it's coming. I'm like, I put the volume all the way down. I'm kind of half looking at the other side, so it doesn't like catch me by surprise.
That's another thing we should do. We should just release jump scare videos that never have something that comes out and make them like 15, 20 minutes long.
Just a close up of me in my regular voice.
Yeah, just like you in your pajamas watching like NASCAR race, just eating. Just no, you know, kind of like the Yule log, you know, but just you sitting there eating.
Well, for the record, I'm going to be eating and watching Super Bowl. I can't eat and watch NASCAR next week. That's the Disney trip. So that, well, it's got to be DVR'd and come back to. Like on the Tuesday, I'll be in my underwear watching some NASCAR.
If this is your first listen, that is Mike there. I know we just kind of threw him on the spot. And fun facts you need to know about Mike. He loves NASCAR. He lives in Georgia. And he's now, he goes to Disney once every 3 weeks or so.
Can't deny it, though. It's like one of those to tell the truth things where they're like, they got to go to judges. And it's like, close enough. We'll allow it. We'll allow it.
But if you're tuning into the show, weekly podcast here that tries to bring you a little bit of banter about life and what's going on and whodunits. I don't know, not whodunits, but play stupid games. And then
murder mystery episode tonight.
We could be. We've done one before. We never solved the murder, unfortunately. In fact, we probably made it worse somehow.
we probably should have done something like actually read a book or done something, get that moving.
Yeah, and then we always pepper in a really interesting guest, and I gotta say, I don't know how long it's been now. It's got to be going on 4 years, 3 or 4 years with the last time we didn't have a guest. So it's been quite a good run. Last week we had Chris Van Vliet, really interesting guy, Emmy Award winner, works for AEW, works for, I don't know. He has a great podcast. He's kind of one of those guys who's kind of done everything on the internet as far as broadcasting. So he was a good time. So, Mike, apparently I hope people don't think like I actually listen to our podcast. Like I never listen to our podcast. Like in the early days, I would put it on and check it out and see if I liked it. Now I don't remember anything we talk about half the time. Okay. I got a text from one of our faithful listeners.
Okay.
And he said, I'm still behind, meaning behind in episodes, but you and Berlew should definitely get colonoscopies together for the podcast. Now, my response was, I mean, we could, but did we talk about that? Like, I didn't know if he was suggesting we do that as a bit, or we were actually talking about it. And apparently in episode 339, we talked about it.
We somewhat did. And we had the weird conversation where we were looking at each other like, dude, do you know how to stay healthy? Or Like, how often do we go to doctors? And we just kind of like, no, not really. It's got to be like,
that's right.
Oh, there's a big growth on me. I guess I should get that checked out.
Yeah. Like I never go back and listen to the, and it probably proves it. There's probably like 40 dead minutes in every episode, but you know, that would be a lot of work. So I put it up there. I cut what I need to, put it together, throw in the interviews, and it's out on the interweb for its existence. Do you ever tune into our cast?
I think early on I would listen to it from time to time. Like once a, like I still never got over like listening to like our voices.
Yeah, I don't like listening to that.
Like I remember for a while, like Izzy would be listening to them with me next to her, and I'm kind of like, I'm not sure if I want to listen to this, babe. And it's like, I need to listen, so go do that in another room.
Yeah.
I want to be close to you, but I only want to be close to you podcast wise at the moment.
Yeah, I remember you,
maybe not in the virtual room.
Early on, you used to listen and tweet out anything that we talked about, which is why you hashtagged the Clan and you hashtagged cocaine to somebody.
I didn't hashtag the Clan. I said big supporter of the Clan to the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
That's well different. It started with a C, that Clan. So see, that doesn't count.
This might be an episode I cut, and I cut that out, and you just say, yeah, I tweeted out big supporter of the Clan. So what? You know, like, just tweet out the Wu-Tang part.
I know your work ethic. I'm not really terrified right now. I gotta be honest.
Yeah. You just gotta be careful, you know. You got, you're going down to Georgia. You got the NASCAR thing. You're supporting the Clan. You know, it's a slippery slope. Yep. It's a slippery slope.
You got the representative talking about the Jew lasers.
Yeah, Jew lasers, man.
Good for her.
I don't know what the hell is going on in this world.
I wonder if it comes to a point where they just grab words out of a bag to come up with a conspiracy theory nowadays. Because it's to the point where it's even like, okay, so we're like, did a bunch of Jewish people come together? Is it like a conglomerate of Jewish people in Israel? Like, can you explain it? Didn't we start a space war force thing?
Yeah, like do the Jews own like the laser game? Like they own Hollywood? Like are they the top? You know, they own every part of the laser business.
Like, I find it hard to believe, like, just a religion just sat back and said, okay, we got this laser technology. We're going to, I guess we'll put it up at night so nobody's looking because they're asleep.
Yeah.
And we'll just start making fires in California. Very random. I mean, I'm not sure if they also blame them for Australia or other fires, but I know it was, I think they said specifically the Jew laser took care of the California fires.
Yeah, I don't know. If someone like in Hollywood is not making a sketch about that right now, like, you know, putting together like a Jewish team that making a laser, they're behind the game already.
Scott, I didn't want to spoil it for you, but that Zack Snyder cut of Justice League, yo.
the enemy is a Jewish laser.
Yeah, it's not Darkseid. It's a Jewish laser. That's literally the character's name, the evil villain in it. He didn't really put anything into it. He's just like, I know what I am and I know what I got.
I mean, it would definitely be better than Suicide Squad. I'm thinking it has a chance about being better. That movie was god awful.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of, two looks good, but then again, one looked good in commercials. I guess the good thing is we all steal HBO Max and get to see for free instead of going into the theaters now. Yeah. So
one, I was so excited for number one. I thought it was going to be a tremendous movie. It was horribly bad. Like I really hate it. They just like introduce characters in the middle of it and then kill them like 10 minutes later. The bad guys were so awful looking. They were like these bubbly looking things. Really bad movie. But should we get a colonoscopy together? Maybe we should, you know, it is COVID time, so maybe we should Zoom each other during it.
So how does that work per se? I mean, do we have to like, are the doctors going to be just cool with, yeah, this is for a podcast bit? Do we bring our wives in? I don't think we can bring anybody in during COVID right now. So it's going to be hard to get the camera set. Lord knows we can't do a selfie.
No, no.
To make it happen.
I'm thinking it's more like, you know, you're kind of chest down, butt up, and right in front of you is the camera. So there's basically, you know, you're laying by your computer, and then I'm laying by my computer, and then in the middle of us, the doctors are doing all the work.
Maybe we could do like a roly-poly kind of armadillo kind of pose, because that way your front will be near your back, and then that way you've got the clear view with the iPhone.
This is this is sounding a little bit human centipede-y right now. This is
well, not connecting us in any way. It's just like, you know, you just take a little yoga, make sure you kind of get your lean up, and just let the camera flow into you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're older. You should be coming up on the colonoscopy first. So maybe I can interview you while you're having yours.
Hey, are we allowed to talk during that? Is that like against a HIPAA violation or something? I don't. And people like really looked at this as an okay item?
I'm pretty sure you're knocked out for it, honestly. I don't think you're like awake as they just explore your butthole.
Well, like as I brought up in a previous episode, like when I was like 21, they thought I might have had cancer there. So they had to do a scope up there. They didn't like knock me out. I mean, they made you a little loopy with some stuff, but I was still conscious during the time.
Right. Well, I don't know. I'm afraid to get a colonoscopy. Deadly afraid.
Are you like the feeling, the results?
The results. Always the results. It's always, they're going to go up there. I'm going to feel perfectly fine before that. They're going to go up there. I wake up and they're like, sir, you have 3 days to live. Like that's the fear.
So as long as they don't tell you like your stay is extended, it's like reverse final destination.
Yeah. Like I'd rather not know and die in those 3 days than know and die in those 3 days. Wouldn't you? Like if you had 3 days to live, you wouldn't want to know you had 3 days left, would you?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think like now, like look, considering COVID, I would like to know I got 3 days because then I would live it up saying if I get COVID, I don't care. But if you didn't know, you would literally just spend the 3 days like sitting around, maybe like going to the local A&P.
Yeah, that would be kind of a bummer if like you look back in your last 3 days, it's just all you lagging around the house like a slob, just like not doing anything.
Like St. Peter is like showing you the what if, and you're like, ah, man.
Would you, if we had 3 days left, would you carve out a 90 minutes so we could do one last podcast? Or would we make the cut?
I think we kind of talked about this before, like if we knew the world was ending, what we would do. I mean, I would probably do one last drive down to Orlando with the wife to be with her in her special place.
Say goodbye to all the Disney characters. Like,
I would make my wife happy. I'm not worried about them waving to me.
So you got to take her to Disney and make her happy as you die? You can't just make her happy in your house?
I would like to think, like...
How far is Disney from your house?
It is about 6 hours.
Okay, so you're talking...
stops, maybe seven.
You're talking 14 hours of driving already, plus some time at the park. Your time is ticking. You got 3 days left.
Look, my thought process is if I can make the wife like uber happy, like one of my last deeds, that's the kind of deal there. I would probably carve at least a half an hour. I mean, maybe I'd skip the interview. It's like Mike would like to be here, but he's dying.
Yeah. Well, what if we had a last episode and you were dying and like we can get any guest on the show? Who would you bring on if you had like one super pick?
Kind of a death row last meal request.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly. Like you had like one, you know, you could talk to anybody in the entire world and they were granting your like, you're kind of like make a wish kind of thing.
Okay. Who would I like to talk to?
Oof. Have to be living. You can't like call in the dead because you'll see them. I mean, you'll see them in a few days.
It's like, wait, you could have made that wish true.
Yeah.
Like somebody would super want to talk to. Maybe Will Ferrell.
It's a good one. I mean, it's a good one.
Yeah, I think he'd be entertaining. Like it would distract me from the whole, oh yeah, the time is ticking on my life cycle kind of deals.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd want to go with someone that like I know would get a bazillion listens as we die. Like if it's my last episode, like I want to bring like Donald Trump on the podcast, like some really controversial figure that
I can see it. The MyPillow guy will talk to us if you want.
I mean, I don't think so, but you know, you never know. He might, or
he's like, got nowhere else to talk, so it's it's Newsmax and us.
I mean, maybe I'd bring like Shaquille O'Neal on the podcast. He seems like he's a lot of fun.
I don't know. He seems I love his career. Like, people give him guff, but seems tiny bit like a fool of himself when he's on the show. Like, he, like, I watched one game where the Jazz player Donovan Mitchell, they interviewed him after a win, and like, he's like, "Hey, Donovan, this is Shaq. I just want to let you know we were talking earlier on the show if you're one of the in the top 10 players in the league," and I said no. He's like, "Okay." He's like, "I want that to motivate you." All right.
See, but that would be great. That would be great on the podcast. Like, "Yes, Mike, I know you're dying in a couple of days, but my life is way better than yours." And
Can you just shut up? Let the real popular person talk. Yeah, just crawl into your grave, okay?
We're not going to miss you whatsoever. Yeah. So
can you get a big order of Papa John's before you go? I got a lot of stock in them.
I don't know, man. If you've seen the clips of Shaq, one where he's at like a rave, and he's like moshing and raving in the crowd of like, it's just like head, gigantic body, and it's Shaq just like dancing around. And then there's that clip of him DJing in his house with his kids. I mean, he seems like a fun guy.
Yeah, I feel like having a party with Shaq, I would fit that into the 3 days. Interviewing Shaq, I got a feeling he'd be a little uppity. See, I got
to
be honest.
This is where you'd have to be creative. You would have to arrange the party at Disney. So you're going down with your wife, and then Shaq happens to be there, and you're like, "Oh, I didn't know this was happening." And you're partying with Shaq. You're with your wife. You guys are in some kind of wacky outfit. The dreams are coming true by the minute. You got to combine them all here.
Yeah, he does live in Florida. I do know that. He was thinking about running for sheriff down there. So that could work, actually. That could work. But that's kind of interesting. Like, we bring up, like, might not be the greatest interview. It's something I was thinking about.
Butterbean?
Like, no. Well, yes, but not my point.
Imagine you were like, "On my deathbed, I want to interview Butterbean one more time to see if it goes better."
What was the greatest moment in boxing? Boxing.
You guys going to ask me anything crazy or what? I don't know. I can barely hear you.
Is there any blood in your urine, Butterbean? Yeah. I wasn't prepared for this.
Yeah.
I think it was about a week and a half ago, Larry King passed away.
Yeah.
Something like that. But one of our comic friends put up a clip of him interviewing Seinfeld, and I guess he wasn't like a fan of Larry King. He kind of bring up he didn't prepare for interviews, but so King was interviewing Seinfeld, and he's like, so what happened at the end, and were you canceled? And Seinfeld just goes on this like hypocritical, "How dare you question my show? We ended number one, blah blah blah." And he was going on for like 5 minutes, and like even going into the commercial, he was just like ripping on him. And it's just one of those things. It's like, I respect Seinfeld, the comedian. I respect Seinfeld, the TV artist.
Yeah.
I don't think I would want to have an interview with him because he just seems too pompous.
Well, I guess you can't tune in next week to our episode, guys, where we interview Jerry Seinfeld. So I guess it's just going to be me and Mike, me and Jerry. That's it.
Yeah, well, be like, I mean, Mike, I'll text you some questions.
Mike set this one out. He didn't. He thought you were going to be too pompous for
him. That's gonna be my Florida day, where I'm saying goodbye to my wife next to Mickey Mouse. Okay.
I think like Dave Chappelle would be one that if I had a couple of days left to get here on the podcast, that might be.
That'd be tight because he's got no filter and he would just let it go. He wouldn't care. He would just say whatever's on his mind.
And he's just too brilliant, man. But yeah, like, so I don't think I could do the colonoscopy thing. I know eventually I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to be my big, like, put my big boy pants on or take my big boy pants off. Yeah, yeah. And schedule that, the old appointment there. But I don't know, man. I'm not good. I know we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but I think it's getting worse as I get older. Like, maybe it's one of those things, like, the longer you put things off, the more you build it up in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I like
kind of like when you get the check engine light on your car.
And then it goes off sometimes, and you're like, yes, it fixed itself.
It must have been the cap or something like that. Yep. And then it comes back, and it's like, oh, that loose cap.
I've done that so many times. Just keep driving, and it goes off. You're like, yeah. And then like a day later, it goes back on. You're like, crap. Didn't fix it. Dude. Like somehow naturally the engine's just gonna be like fix itself underneath there.
Yeah, you're like calling up GM. Yeah, is there a way the light can recheck to make sure the engine's fine?
Yeah,
because I feel like if I ask you to check, you're gonna find something bad. But as long as the light goes off, I'm good. Is there a way to remove the light? Out of curiosity.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I guess before we get to our guest, I did one more virtual show on Friday night. Another one. This one happened to be for my cousin's company, and I don't know, man. Like every time I have one of these, because it's so far, it's so long in between doing sets that I'm like, oh god, gotta think of jokes, gotta remember my stuff, gotta, I'm not performing live at all. The last live show I did was in August or September, something like that. And it was good. It went really well. It was really funny. Like listening to, I always like have them do something beforehand, like the company. So it's not just like log on comedy show, boom. Like they were doing like a trivia show for their company, like a, you know, just to kind of warm people up and get them in. And I'm like listening to their chatter and they're like, it's so funny what like, non-comics talk about. They're like, oh yeah, I had a, you know, tooth operation. I have, because they were doing like fun facts, like who had, what is, you know, two truths about Mike and a lie. One of them was like, has four fake teeth. And the woman was like, I have four fake teeth. And then another one chimed in like, I have seven fake teeth. And then another one chimed in was like, oh, these couple teeth, like they went on for like 6 minutes about who had real teeth in the audience.
Is that like bragging in most offices? Just like, no, you think like you think like when they get back after all this COVID, some person walks up, just removes their dentures from their mouth, slams on the table. It's like, I win.
Yeah. I don't know. But it was funny. Cause this was like this was for a group that, services and teaches autistic kids. So these were like pretty educated people. So, and it's funny. And then they're talking about like, oh, remember Kara, the last Christmas party, you puked all over the place. We had to drive you home. And then next one's like, oh yeah, I don't even remember that party. I'm like, oh my God. Like, I'm just like listening. Like, so like I went up with jokes prepared, but then instead I just wrote down like a list of like things people said. And then another one was like, I used to have a pet snake. I'm like, what is going on here? I'm like, no teeth, pet snake, alcoholism. I'm like, what kind? I'm like, no wonder your students love you, man. Like, you guys are fun. Like, it was like a white trash seminar there. I mean, they weren't white trash.
Yeah, you should have promoted the podcast when you were on there. I feel that's our perfect audience right there.
We did. That's my intro. But yeah, overall, it was really cool. Had some really good comics on, got, you know, did our thing, and we have one more in 2 weeks. So we'll see how that goes. And then my comedy calendar is once again officially zero, nothing, nada, nothing on the horizon. So please, COVID, go away. So maybe one day I could perform again in front of people. And it's funny, there are places open, but it seems like all the comics that are getting work are like well-known comics. Like they're all the big comics are doing the smaller places because the big places aren't open. So,
I mean, it kind of makes sense just for them to stay fresh and whatever, and they'll do it on the cheap. And a lot of these shows are just going to be like, well, I'm never going to be able to get them at this price again. So,
yep. I will give credit to, Joel Richardson, Soul Joel. He like I worked for him once, maybe twice, but he opened his own comedy club right before COVID, like right before. And he ended up building an outdoor stage with like sand in front of it where everybody can sit. Then as it got colder, he built like a it's like a giant, it's not a tent, it's all scaffolding. So it looks like a dome almost. It looks like a...
like an igloo.
Yeah, it's amazing. He put heaters in there, and he's got everyone coming through there. Louis came down there. I just saw he has Russell Peters coming next week. I think he had Big Jay Oakerson, Jim Brewer. Like, I was like, damn, I give that guy a lot of credit. Now I'm curious, like, after this all ends, his club might be, like, one of the big, you know, one of the big clubs because all these guys are performing there. So, all right. Time to segue to our guest. And we got a good one today. Berlo, who we got on the show?
Scott, today we're going to be talking with author and journalist Matthew O'Brien. He is well known for his book, Beneath the Neon, a whole story of how some people in Las Vegas, homeless people, are living in underneath the sewers in Las Vegas under the water tunnels. And we're going to be chatting with him on how he found out about this and all the stories he found out from it. His new book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, has been out as well. So he'll be telling us about that book as well.
All right. Let's get Matt O'Brien on the show.
So before we get into talking about your book and everything, I noticed you grew up in Georgia. Is that right?
Yeah. So just are we starting the recording, the interview, or is this just background?
We're good to go.
Yeah, we're good to go.
Okay. So, yeah, I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up in the Atlanta, Georgia area. That's where I went to high school and college. And then after college, I moved to Las Vegas, Nevada, where I lived for almost 20 years. Now, I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this. I left Las Vegas about 3.5 years ago to teach in Central America.
Oh, nice. So where are you at? Where are you at right now?
I'm in my apartment, kind of in the foothills of San Salvador, El Salvador.
All right. I think that might be the first time we've had someone on the show calling in from Central America there. So you're setting records already.
Cool. I'm recording from your old stomping grounds. I live in Douglasville, Georgia.
Oh, okay. I finished at West Georgia. I played basketball in college, and I started at Georgia State. Then I transferred to West Georgia and finished there in Carrollton.
So did you grow up like wanting to write, or were you always into writing and literature and whatnot, or was that something that developed later on?
Well, my dad was an English professor at Georgia Tech for 30 some odd years, and so there were always books around the house. But when I was growing up, I was into sports. You know, when I was young, I played baseball, and then I got into soccer, and then eventually kind of fixated on basketball and played that in high school and college. It wasn't till about halfway through my college career when I realized I wasn't going to play basketball professionally that I kind of got more serious about my education and getting into a degree. And I majored in history at West Georgia. And to get a history degree, you had to do a lot of reading, research, and writing. And that's when I discovered that I really liked that whole process. And I went back, my dad had books all over the house that I had ignored for most of my life. And that's when I went back kind of late in college or just after college and started reading some of these books that he had lying around.
So when you went to Las Vegas and you were a writer and editor, did you have any kind of investigative background before you started to looking into the tunnels in Las Vegas, or was it just like a curiosity piece that you heard of and you wanted to dive into further?
No, when I got my history degree from West Georgia, I moved back to Atlanta and was really living like a starving artist lifestyle. I was delivering the newspaper, the afternoon Atlanta Journal, and then at night I would read, in the mornings I would write, then I would go deliver the paper route, and, you know, just living check to check in a loft in downtown Atlanta. And I really needed a change. And being an aspiring writer, I had never been to Las Vegas, but Vegas was becoming really hip and popular at that point. This was mid to late 90s. And, you know, I was into sports betting too, growing up in the South. I had not seen much of the West or Southwest. So my roommate and I kind of talked each other into moving out to Vegas, maybe to stay for 6 months or a year. I ended up staying for almost 20 years, and he's actually still there.
So let's kind of dive into your books and your story. So for what I understand, you got kind of interested with the investigating the tunnels in Las Vegas because there was a murderer, I believe, Timmy T.J. Walker, that kind of hid down there before he got caught. Was when you kind of like read into this, were you kind of looking into this as like investigating where he was, or were you, did you have like deeper meaning knowing there were other people down there, or what was the initial steps and what did you discover?
So when I moved to Vegas in 1997, I was working temp jobs and started freelancing. I broke in at the Sun covering sports, and then I started writing for an alt weekly newspaper called City Life, which was kind of like a smaller version of what the Village Voice was, or Creative Loafing, or LA Weekly, and gradually went on staff at City Life and worked my way up to editor of that publication. And one day I was in my office at City Life, and I had read about a murderer, an accused murderer. Timmy T.J. Weber was actually his name. He had told police that he had used the underground flood channels to evade them, and that was mentioned in the morning paper. And that gave me that. I wondered what this guy encountered down in these underground flood channels. I didn't know anything about them at the time, but I had this image of kind of like The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. That movie, feeling his way through, being chased by Tommy Lee Jones, you know, that kind of thing. So I went down with another writer for City Life, and we started looking for and exploring these underground flood channels. That's how it started way back in spring of 2002.
Now is this like something that is like illegal to go in? Like, or you have to like sneak around to get in? Is this like a something you have to prepare for with like gear and whatnot, or are you just like, hey, we're just gonna go in and see what happens? What was the initial, you know, initial way in?
Yeah, well, I had actually assigned the story to a freelance writer for City Life, a guy named Josh Ellis, who's kind of a Hunter S. Thompson renegade first person writer. I didn't figure I would have the time to kind of deal with this kind of assignment. So I assigned it to him. Then I followed up with him a couple weeks later, and he said he had been to one tunnel and walked it for miles, and it was wet and there were crawfish, and in the manhole shaft, he could see clothing and stuff hanging down, I guess, from homeless camps above ground were using it to like stash. And he told me enough that I got really interested. And I said, well, when are you going to go check out more of these tunnels? You know, and he didn't have a car at the time. So I agreed to pick him up that weekend and drive him around to look for tunnels. And then I just started going in with him, and we ended up co-writing two stories in City Life that went viral before that was really a term. This was 2002. The net was just kind of growing at that point. Yeah. But that feedback from the stories we wrote in City Life that were reposted online gave me the feeling that there might be a book here, something bigger than a couple newspaper articles.
So how far did you have to go in to actually see like communities or whatever people in there? Is it just like literally when you walk in, or are you like going for hours and all of a sudden come across these people?
Yeah, the writer Josh and I didn't know anything about these underground flood channels. All we knew is that this crazed murderer had, you know, used them to get away from the police, and we wanted to see what was down there. I was expecting, you know, maybe some graffiti, some weird debris that had washed in. It was not common knowledge that people were living down in there. And Josh and I started exploring these tunnels. And when we first came upon a person down in there, a little homeless camp, we were shocked. We were shocked. And then we started to interview a few more people. But that's part of the reason I wanted to go back down for a book, because Josh and I had explored 4 or 5 tunnels, only interviewed a few people briefly. I wanted to explore the whole underground flood system and really get in depth with the people who are living down there about their lives and their situations in the city of Las Vegas.
So what is the reaction like when you're like, you know, you're this, you know, you're this guy that's clearly not, you're not homeless. You're not in the situation that, you know, the people you're interviewing and learning about are in, and you enter into this world and you try to start talking to people. What is the initial reaction from the people who are living down there? Are they open to talking to you, or do they feel like you're kind of invading their space?
So when Josh and I went down, he was carrying a big knife, like an 18-inch kukri knife, and I had a golf club that was like a walking stick, and it could test the depths of water down there as well. And we had hard hats on and trench coats, and we would actually stop at the front of the tunnel, the entrance, and kind of yell in, "Yo, anyone here as if someone would say, "Yeah, come on in, guys," you know. We were really naive, but I learned enough going down with Josh, you know, that when I went back down on my own to research the book, I was dressed more casually, more like a homeless person would be. I had a beanie cap on and a flashlight. And I did have an expandable baton, a foam handle that when you flick it, a steel rod pops out. I had that in the small of my back, you know, but not open, you know. And I had known a little bit more about the etiquette then. And part of the etiquette is, if you get to a homeless camp, you don't enter without permission down there. You have to kind of announce yourself, let them know who you are, and then they give you the yay or nay. So I would just, when I came to a camp, I would say, "Anyone here?" And you would hear this echo in the tunnels, "Anyone here? Anyone here? Anyone here?" And then, you know, sometimes it would have to say it 2 or 3 times, and then someone would say, yeah, what's going on? And I would say, I'm a journalist, just curious about the tunnels. Do you mind if I cut through?" Nah, man, come on through. And then I would stop and kind of offer them some water and engage them from that point. And a lot of times that led to 2-hour interviews down there that I recorded, or even me coming back for, you know, longer, more in-depth conversations with those people.
I picture you with the golf club, like pretending you're trying to find your ball. Like, "Oh, just looking for my ball.
Hazard.
Bad drive.
It's funny you mention that, because a few of the tunnels go underneath an exclusive golf course, and you would have golf balls that would roll in them, you know, randomly, or some of the guys would collect golf balls and sell them to make a little money on the streets.
They're like, "Wow, this guy's committed to not taking a stroke." You know.
So what are the their cognitive senses? Are like most of them kind of like just, I don't want to say normal, but you kind of don't show any kind of like mental issues, where they're just on hard times, or we're dealing with a lot of druggies? What's the kind of sense of the people down there?
Well, my first book, Beneath the Neon, was a first-person adventure story, just me exploring these tunnels and sharing my thoughts on Vegas from this unique perspective beneath it. And then these long conversations I had with the people down there. My latest book is called Dark Days, Bright Nights. And in that, I interviewed 36 people that made it out of these tunnels, either on their own, kind of crawling on their knees to get out of these things, or through my Shine a Light program, or help of Southern Nevada, or some other nonprofit. And in the interviews, I asked the people, you know, and in the latest book, you know, going all the way back to their childhood, all the way up to arriving in Vegas, discovering the tunnels, then all the way through getting out and recovery and their hopes for the future. So, you know, there's a variety of people, drugs. I mean, most of the people down there are addicted to gambling, drugs, alcohol, or some combination of those three things. But that doesn't really mean that's why they ended up homeless or, you know, in the tunnels. Usually there's a deeper issue, some trauma that happened to them in their lives that led them to an addiction, which in turn led them to the tunnels.
Now, what is it that is taking you back? Like, you know, you made one very successful book and you're back for another one. And you see, like, what brings you kind of to come back and talk to these people more and get more content? What is it about it for you that keeps you going back there?
Well, in more than 20 years as a journalist, this is the only story that I wrote and then have stayed with for this long. Yeah, right. And it's just the original two articles, the reaction was so strong, and my curiosity was so strong about what else was down in there. And that led to Beneath the Neon. And then when I was down there researching Beneath the Neon, I really got to know some of these people in the tunnels, going back for follow-up interviews. And I didn't pay them for their interviews, but I would come back and bring water and food and, you know, little gifts for them and stuff like that. So I started developing relationships with them. And a big part of it, admittedly, was the media. You know, once Beneath the Neon was published and it got out there online that these tunnels existed and I was kind of the point person for them, media from around the world, you guys wouldn't believe it. I still don't fully understand the fascination, but I mean, you know, not in the U.S. In fact, more outside of the U.S., England, France, Germany, there are countries in South America, Asia that reached out to me to kind of go down in there. And if they weren't a tabloid, if they weren't going to sensationalize or make the people down there look like criminals, you know, generally I would work with them to raise awareness and to raise money for my Shine a Light program, which helps the people down in there. So it was kind of just, you know, it started with the articles and it just grew and grew and grew. This latest book, Dark Days, Bright Nights, feels like a follow-up of sorts to Beneath the Neon. And it feels like closure for me. Beneath the Neon showed the dark life down in there and the dark side of Vegas. And it only felt fair to tell the other end of the story about these people getting out and turning around their lives. And
it's interesting. And I mean, together. You think about it. I think people are just inherently fascinated with subcultures. I mean, everything on Discovery Channel is about people living in the wilderness or, you know, bush people in Alaska. And, you know, I think, you know, where everything on TLC is overweight people or short, you know, like it seems like we're always fascinated with like some kind of subculture or something that's different. So I guess I understand the reaction to your book.
Yeah. But there is beyond just that. It's like something about underground, right? You know, like the catacombs of Paris or the subway and train tunnels of New York.
Yeah, it reminds me of the mole people. Like, I remember hearing about the mole people growing up.
And now the underground flood channels of Las Vegas, you know, the human race, of course, has a history with caves and surviving underground. So maybe it's part of our nature to be curious about that. It doesn't hurt that these tunnels were under Las Vegas. So you have that incredible contrast, you know, from the bright neon lights to these dark and gray tunnels where people are just barely getting by.
Right.
I mean, when you do a story like this for so long, does it ever get to you in some ways? Because I could just imagine like the juxtaposition of like going into these tunnels for hours and hours and talking to people, and then you leave and you're like on the strip of Las Vegas where it's parties everywhere and all. Getting to know these people have any kind of effect on you in some way mentally?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I've thought about that a little bit, you know, well, quite a bit actually. And really what I take most away from the whole tunnel experience is it's given me a lot of perspective, you know, on life. You know, if things aren't going well with the girlfriend or, you know, if I'm not getting as much work as I would like. You think about these stories from the tunnels, the people I met down there and encountered, especially the ones for Dark Days, Bright Nights, and you just have more perspective about life and more appreciation for what you have. That's a big part of it to me.
So you got the new book out, which we'll ask you in a minute where people can go check that out. But what's in the future for you as far as, like, do you have an idea for a next project? Are you extending this thought to a different area, or are you working on something completely different?
Well, yeah, in Vegas for 20 years, I did mostly nonfiction writing, but I like to write fiction, you know, short novels and short stories. And in my last several years in Vegas, I kept a folder of story ideas, just interesting little stories I came across in Vegas. Some of them are related to the tunnels, some related to homelessness in general, or just everyday real life in Las Vegas. And now, after teaching 3 years full time down here, I'm taking a year or so off just to kind of, you know, do some creative writing, focus on myself a little bit more. So I've been writing short stories set in Vegas. Mm-hmm. A lot cool. of the themes, the general themes are, yeah, about homelessness, about addiction there, and about kind of the real life in Las Vegas.
Mm. Cool. You also made the foundation shine a light to help out with funding people and helping them get out of drug addiction and out of the tunnels. I'm kind of curious, you know, have you had much conversations with, like, politicians about the situation there? Because I mean, I hear it all the time. I hear, like, San Fran, there's a lot of problems. As I go into the city here in Atlanta, I see a lot of homelessness there. Has there been any kind of reach out to you from higher ups kind of saying, what can we do? How can we help, or anything like that?
Not as much as I would have hoped. That was kind of my greatest hope when I wrote Beneath the Neon, was that people would, you know, raise awareness and the government or a nonprofit would do something to help the people down there. My greatest fear, of course, was that the cops would go in these tunnels and try to sweep all the people out. Neither one of those things was really realized. And that's why I founded Shine a Light in 2009. It was very grassroots at the time. Me just going down with water, canned goods, socks, underwear, kind of going down with these people. And then people started donating stuff to me to take down. So I became kind of a middleman between people who did want to help the people in the tunnels and the people down there themselves. But no, it was usually just everyday people, either in Vegas or out of Vegas, who would send me money or send me goods. But luckily, before I moved to Central America, I passed Shine a Light off to a nonprofit in Las Vegas, Sober House Freedom Living. And a guy that used to live in the tunnels, who is a case manager there, is now running Shine a Light, going down on a regular basis, offering housing, drug counseling, anything someone could need down there, they're offering. And he's brought other people out of the tunnels, and they're going back down with them. So Shine a Light's become an official program, mostly run by people who used to live in the tunnels, and with, you know, big backing and funding, again, not necessarily from the corporations and companies, though we get some of that support, but more so just from everyday people who care about this issue.
So the book is called Dark Days, Bright Nights. Where's the best place for people to go check it out, or follow you, or go order the book? What's the best place to go find it?
Well, if you happen to live in Vegas, there's a really good bookstore downtown called the Writer's Block that always has hard copies of the book there. That would be a good place to go in Vegas. Outside of Vegas, it's in all the usual places, wherever you get your books, Amazon.com. The publisher is called Central Recovery Press. They're based in Vegas, and they specialize in addiction and recovery literature. So you could go to Central Recovery Press, Google them. Their website will come up, BarnesandNoble.com, etc. By the way, though, I should say that with this book, 25% of the money I make off Dark Days, Bright Nights is going back in to Shine a Light to help the people who are still down there. So yeah, that's made me more ambitious about promoting it. And the people I interviewed in the book really want to give back to the people who are still down there too. So we're all pretty excited about that.
That's awesome. No, it's an amazing story. I'm definitely going to go out and get the book, and we definitely appreciate you telling your story on here. Not to throw a joke in here on top of everything, but I gotta ask, with all those miles of tunnels and everything, did you ever have a night where you literally said, oh God, I think I'm lost?
Yeah, and a moment like that's documented in Beneath the Neon, where I had entered this tunnel that was about 6 feet high, and I went in, and I'm 6 foot two, and my boots, I was about 6'3 or 6'4, so that wasn't too much of a problem. But I went in, and it went from a square tunnel to a circular kind of big pipe, and was maybe 5 feet high. Mm-hmm. And it was underneath a major street, so you had exhaust fumes coming down in there, and the tunnel kept getting smaller, and you get to a point where you're like, am I going to turn around, or might the exit be, you know, just around the next bend or whatever? And I must have gone almost 3 miles into this tunnel. Wow. was out of water, having trouble breathing. You can't really pop a manhole cover because you might get decapitated by a
yeah. I've
seen a lot of them in Vegas in the summertime. It's like a frying pan, and they're really just, they're almost like fried onto the hole. They're very tough to get off. And eventually it just dead ended, this tunnel dead ended. And I had to just kind of collapse there and rest. And then I worked my way back out the same way I'd come in. But you can get turned around in there. And more so, you can get in a lot of trouble with the people who are down there. If you don't know the rules, the etiquette, there's some rough characters down there that you know, you would have to watch out for.
With like the success of the book and the articles and whatnot, did you get a lot of people who wanted to go down with you? Like, oh, can we go? Can you take us for a tour or whatnot? Did you get a lot of interest in that?
Yeah, and just random people emailing, tourists from all over the world. I'm coming to Vegas. I want to check out the tunnels. You know?
We're going to go to the Bellagio.
Like, I'm going to give them exact directions so they can go down there. You know, it's just like, and I would usually say, hey, read the book and you can maybe figure out where some things are. Yeah, but it's not as many as you would think. It takes a certain kind of personality and character to really want to go down in there. And even if you do go down and peek in, as far as like really going in deep, it takes some nerve and some gear. You know, you have to, ideally you would have waterproof boots, flashlight, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah.
No, awesome. Matt, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Really enjoyed speaking to you, and good luck with the book, and looking forward to what you have next on the horizon.
Appreciate it, guys. Take care.
All right. Matt O'Brien. Berlo, you ever think about venturing into the underground there in Georgia? See what's going on underneath the subterranean levels of where you live? You already did the murder trail.
Like Southern Georgia and just probably come up with the same results as Matthew found.
I mean, you're frequent to the murder trail, so, I mean.
Yeah, well, there's only been one murder there. So
that you know of,
Yeah, I mean, I would prefer if you call it the one murder trail. That makes it feel way more safer than.
Yeah, that's true. Like, the murder trail, it seems like it to earn that name, it should have several murders on it. I mean, it's not, it's really.
Yeah.
One murder, yeah, you know, like, what are we gonna call it? Give it the whole trail just for one person? I don't know. I feel like if I got killed on the road over here, they wouldn't be calling it like Dead Scott, you know, Street.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, plus this trail is from one side of Georgia to into Alabama. So
that's a lot of room to murder. That's a lot of acres you could bury people.
And not knowing the story, I'm guessing the guy never came back and tried it again. I mean, that'd be pretty gutsy of him to attempt something like that.
Or he got really good. Like, he just got really good at the murder, and he hasn't been caught.
I mean, I don't know. I think he was caught. I would have to Google it. But at the same time, like, after you, like, do that on the trail, I'm fairly confident, like, people be looking on the trail. For you, so
right,
like, the least he could do is like go to another state and find another trail.
Yeah, I feel like also if, like staying on the trail is probably not the best idea. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of footprints, a lot of scent on a trail mm-hmm. where, you know, the dogs or the man pups can come out and find you. So I feel like staying in the dirt wouldn't be the best. I feel like you got to get off your murder spot and go to a new murder trail.
Yeah, or at the very least, like, come up with, like, a new concept. Like, maybe, like, hold a butcher's knife while riding a bike, chasing a biker on the trail instead of just grabbing a jogger.
Yeah. When we were talking to him, it kind of reminded me when I was, I think, in high school. Yeah, probably high school. We went to, like, one of those weird New Jersey I actually don't think it was in New Jersey. I think it was in New York. It might have been in like Staten Island. I don't want to get this wrong, but whatever. It was an old asylum / medical hospital. And I was never really into like that kind of, I don't know. I always kind of stayed away from like, oh, let's go down this old murder, blah, 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 and check it out and see who's around. But I had a friend, Ray, who was really into it. And there was like these two girls with us that, you know, they were girls that were actually talking to us. So that was like a miracle in itself. So I was like, yeah.
Was this like your first date?
No, it wasn't even a date. It was just four people going to check out this abandoned asylum thing.
I was about to say, I mean, I know first dates are awkward, but bringing her to a haunted psych ward, probably not the greatest first date. Like maybe the third one where you're allowed to like, do things afterwards, you know, where she's like scared, like I can't go home. And you're like cha-ching.
You know, as you're saying that, I feel like I might be lying to the audience because it might have been a monastery, a former monastery in New York. I wonder if it'll pop up. We're in the abandoned.
Well, you're googling. I'm going to Google if they ever caught the guy in the murder trail.
Oh. Pause, guys, while we Google.
Yeah, go to the White Noise podcast for a little bit. We'll be right back with you.
Here it is. Got it. It was a monastery, so it wasn't a psych ward. It was the St. Augustine Monastery in Staten Island, New York. Constructed in 1899. It was a training academy. That sounds weird. For nuns and priests. It was closed in 1983. According to legend, a monk who was accused of murdering several other members of the monastery is said to haunt the property where the building once stood, along with the spirits of the victims. Okay, investigators at St. Augustine have reported witnessing apparitions, hearing disembodied voices, footsteps, and other strange sounds. So yeah, that's what it was. And it's funny because like my memory is like fading so much now from like those times, but I remember being definitely scared, but you know, not showing it at all, but inside freaking out.
You had your big boy pants on, so you were good.
Yeah. And it was, I remember we had to sneak in under some fence, and like, this was before like the internet was like really like you couldn't find much about it. You just kind of heard about it, had an address, and like went. I think we probably put it in like a TomTom or a GPS or something like that. And we went there, and I remember like them saying that under the ground there were like eight sub levels, like eight basements. And I'm like, oh boy, I'm not going in those. And they like the one kid was gung ho, like, oh, we got to go in these sub levels and all the stuff. And basically I got there and it was definitely, you could tell like the homeless had lived there a long time. Like there's just beer cans everywhere, spray paint everywhere, like some sleeping bags, box Coors Light boxes, things like that. But I do remember being extremely freaked out because we definitely heard, the only thing I can remember hearing and being freaked out by was, we heard like the sound of chains dragging like upstairs, like just like shh, like chain. Now it could have been like another group of people checking it out. It could have been someone up there walking around, but it was definitely a little off-putting. We had flashlights and everything. We went in. I'd say we were in there 15 minutes and we're like, let's get out of here. But it kind of reminded me of that when we were interviewing Matt.
For the record, Michael Ledford, the one who is convicted of the murderer, he is on death row in Georgia.
Can we get him on the podcast? He's not doing much.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like,
we haven't done that yet.
Quarter for you, the payphone for your one call, and I'm not sure how long that quarter is going to last.
What if
I'm basing this off of most jail movies I've seen from the 1990s? So,
what if we like, are we allowed to send him like a bucket of quarters so he can talk to us?
I don't know how you ship a bucket of quarters, to be honest. I mean, that's got to be pretty heavy. It's probably going to be 10 times more expensive, the shipment, than the actual money in the shipment.
Yeah, that's something we've never done here on the show. We've never interviewed someone from jail, so it could be a first.
I mean, if you talk about shenanigans, there's nothing more shenanigans than being in jail, I guess. I don't know.
But yeah, you ever have any like weird haunted place experience, anything like that?
I'm trying to think. I mean,
Disney?
Nothing I can really fathom. Like, even like as I've gotten older and like done these like ghost tours and everything like that, I really haven't seen much. I do know, like, I think I brought up in a podcast way long ago, like when me and Izzy were down in Cape May and we did the haunted tours there. I snapped a bunch of pictures and it seemed like one picture had kind of like a silhouette of a face in the window, but it was nothing where I'm like, oh my God, this is freaking me out or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess now the only haunted thing you're ever going to see again is the Haunted Mansion at Disney. So
that could be true. And that would be my nightmare and all. And if you want something scary, if in my 3 days I'm stuck in Disney and I die at the Haunted Mansion, I am going to haunt that thing like a mofo. Like, I'm going to a new level.
You ever think you saw a ghost before in your life? You ever think, like, thought you had an experience?
Nothing I can really think of, no. About the closest like spiritual thing I've had, I think I brought this up on the show before also, like, I had an aunt who was like uber religious.
That is scary.
They were like cleaning their house and they looked at the screen door and there was a stain on it, and then she brought her son in and she's like, I forget which son it was, but the kid was like, Mommy, that looks like Jesus Christ. So she like hung on to a screen door all her life.
That's like Always Sunny when they bless the stain. They have the Mary stain. Yeah. The only time I remember was I must have been in like fifth grade. Funny enough, that's the one time I went down to Disney. And we didn't stay in Disney. A friend of my father's had like a timeshare down there. Somewhere like kind of by a golf course. And I remember laying in bed and looking up and seeing this white, I couldn't explain it. It almost looked like water moving like on the ceiling. Okay. And like this kind of white floating thing. Now, of course, I'm in fifth grade. Could have been anything. Could have been light shining. I'm thinking we were on a golf. Like, as I got older, I'm like, maybe it was like light coming off, you know, like a water trap or something on the golf course and bouncing into. But I remember being freaked out for like hours, thinking that a ghost was there and like hiding under my blankets and being completely scared until like daylight came. But that's really my only ghost experience, if you will.
Huh. Well, if you can get through that, you can get through a colonoscopy.
Okay, I think I'd rather see the ghost.
It'd be great if you were like, the doctor comes in and then you jump under the covers. Just to, you can't hurt me in here, doctor.
Mr.
Brennan, we really need to check out your bowel movements. Nope, under the covers. Nope, not a scared adult in here. Nope.
Well, that's a funny past episode of the podcast. Remember, we were gonna do the Ouija board.
At the haunted ghost,
the haunted vape shop.
Yep.
Were you headlined, Mike? You ran your headliner set.
I was never, I was listed as a headliner. Technically, I was not the headliner. Who was it? It was Larry Goldberg. Because nobody showed up. And since he brought the only two people for the show, he became the headliner on that.
Wasn't that John Sweeney? Oh, maybe it was Larry Goldberg. I don't know. Whatever. Doesn't matter. But yeah, we did a podcast with the owner.
And somebody.
And this girl, Melissa Allen, who may or may not be dead. So some rumors out there saying that she might not be dead. But I don't want to spread things that are, we don't know if it's true. But put it this way, wouldn't surprise, if there was a person I could pick that might not be dead, yeah, that would fake a death, it would be her. So
yeah, there's two people I could think of.
Yes, I agree. Yep.
and she is one of them. Mm-hmm. Second one, that's another questionable story. I won't even give hints on this show on that story, but
second one might be currently faking a disease, but who knows. Berla, what do you got before we go?
Well, Scott, I saw that you guys got hit with a pretty big nor'easter.
We did.
Up there in New Jersey. About how many inches did you get up there?
I'd have to say I have 2 feet of snow.
Wow.
Yes, a lot.
It was like 2 feet as in it fell 2 feet, or also like the winds came up and you have banks that are up to 2 feet or
no,
more?
No, I'd say it probably fell 2 feet.
Wow.
And of course, this is the second time I got a snowblower for free. One was from a former comic, and it never worked. and then this one, my dad came over like the weekend before, and I was like, can you help me get the snowblower running okay? Because I knew snow was coming. Running like a top, and then as soon as I go outside, I'm using it, it craps out. So I'm shoveling later on in the day, and my neighbor... she has some like ex-husband that's around every once in a while. I don't know. He's like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, you know, this sucks. He's like, yeah. Tell me about it. I'm like, yeah, man, my snowblower just, of course, picked the worst time. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm a mechanic, right? I'm like, oh.
Mm.
And he came over, sure enough, got it started. I let him use it, get his driveway done. And it was like a miracle. It was like, if we didn't cross paths at that time, I might still be shoveling. But
now, is that the same neighbor that stole your plate for a couple months?
Yeah. Yeah. She stole the plate, though. He's like around, like, I'll see him once every couple of months. I don't know. Maybe they have like an on and off thing. But
well, I mean, you got your plate back and you got your snowmower blower going. So that's great.
Yeah.
But
I also have my crazy neighbor, Boris, my Russian neighbor, Boris, that I told you about. I don't know if I told you. Last time on Thanksgiving, I don't think I told this on the podcast. On Thanksgiving, we just had two people over because I couldn't see my family because my mom had the Rona. And I go outside and I'm like, oh, we went outside to smoke a cigar. And I was like, oh, Boris is out there. I just wanted to say happy Thanksgiving. As soon as I say happy Thanksgiving, he's like, Scotty! Now I could tell he's probably had 12 vodkas already. Brings me over. I'm like, oh, crap. And I'm like to my friend Dave, come over here. And he goes into everything from, he told me that he's a criminal, that he escaped Russia, that he had to live in Germany for a while, that he invented the security on ATM machines. He's the reason. He told me that he has a 7-foot-tall friend that he was in the army with that likes to hang out and how tall he is. He told me that his wife had a liver transplant. He told me that there's two things in life he takes seriously. It's alcohol and meat. I was like, oh, I'm trying to go. I'm like, oh, I got a kid. I got to get going. He's like, God bless you. God bless you. And he's like, to his daughter, he's like, get the tequila. I'm like, oh, I can't do kids. He's like, I have to send my daughter for the tequila because I know you guys will leave if I go upstairs for it. so, yeah, he was – and then he's drunk. He's cooking lamb. He's, like, giving us pieces of lamb. I'm like, Jesus Christ. So, yeah, that's my other neighbor, Boris. But I like Boris. Like, one day I'm going to invite Boris over and just have a grand old time.
Mm. Was Boris ever on the trail in Georgia by any curiosity?
I wouldn't be surprised. He might be that the guy in death row might be innocent. It might have been Boris.
I keep telling you, it's the Russian guy who smells like lamb. But going back to with all everything that happened with the weather-wise, I would look through my old school book of stories, and I found a story called Snow.
Oh, we've heard so many classics from here, like My Friend Blackie.
Cinderella.
Cinderella, yeah. So what grade was this, fifth grade?
Somewhere in the third to fifth grade, somewhere in that territory.
All right, Mike, why don't you take us out with my fifth grade Mike Berlew's story about snow.
Snow. Michael Berlew.
Ooh, I like the voice.
Last night, when I looked outside, the snowflakes were coming down. The wind was blowing hard, and the full moon was out. I went to bed and couldn't wait till morning time came so I could go outside after breakfast. When I woke up in the morning, my dad told me that there was 4 inches of snow.
You're really hammering home that it's the morning, you know?
Yeah. I can't assume my readers understand anything. Now, I know he fell asleep at night, but when he woke up, what time was it? 4 inches of snow on the ground, and I was excited to go out and play. When I was finished with my cereal, I put on warm clothes and went out and jumped in the snow, and my dog Sam followed me. We had fun rolling in the snow and getting it all over us.
Sounds a little romantic.
I made big snowballs and threw, I said T-H-R-O-U-G-H instead of T-H-R-E-W.
Gotcha.
Them at Sam. And he tried to catch them. Then I constructed a nice snowman, and Sam tried to knock it down. We were getting cold, so we went in by the fire to get warm. We had fun, and it was a fantastic day.
Not bad. It's actually pretty wholesome. Did you actually have a Sam?
Sammy was our first dog. Okay. Yes. He hated me.
Yeah, well, maybe if you stop throwing snowballs at him.
Well, that was a fictional story. The real, honest to true story of Sammy is I think I've said on the podcast before, but when I was 5 years old, I picked him up and I tripped and I dropped him. The dog lived 16 years. 21-year-old Mike still could not pick up the dog without him growling at me. For that one time 16 years ago that I tripped and bam, fell.
He was, damn. You drop him. Was, you throw snowballs at him.
I allowed him to attack the snowman. I mean, come on.
You know, that story was pretty wholesome. It wasn't as weird as Cinderella or My Friend Blackie. That was. It sounded like it came from a good place. I mean, you really focused on the fact that it was morning. I mean, you had to throw in that you were eating cereal. You had to throw in that it was morning. It was after 9 o'clock. Like, we get it. It's morning. It's morning.
As I was eating my cereal, I said, Mom, is it still morning? And she said, yes, Michael, it is still morning. I said, Mother, I am going outside in the morning snow. She said, go ahead. It's the morning. You may enjoy it. Be back by the afternoon.
As I was heading out the door, I said, good morning, Dad. Oh, man. All right, time to get out of here, Berlew. Anything to promote before we roll?
Since we brought up Disney, I'll bring up our travel agent, Christina Rush, with Magic Travel. She has helped us out on very numerous Disney vacations. I would say just a couple more, but I'm logical here.
Right.
She's a wonderful person. She is a great planner. She got us upgraded to the Grand Floridian in Disney World this coming trip. And this is a whole resort that usually goes for near 1,000-something a night, and all we're getting in there. On a very low price. She works very hard. She works 9 days. I mean, believe me, if you have any questions whatsoever on how to set up your trip, she will bend over backwards to help you out. She loves her job, and she's a wonderful person. Check her out on Facebook. Christine Rush with Magic Travel.
All right. And I'm going to promote us, but in a different way. So, yes, we do the podcast here weekly, but I had mentioned it before. We did a virtual show. I've done a whole bunch of them. So when COVID is over, we should be back to running a couple shows a month or a couple shows a year or whatever. But been really having some success with the virtual shows. And it really is a great thing to kind of offer. We found employees or do something for like a comedy happy hour for workers. Some people have done it like, hey, we have our normal meetings at this day at 5 o'clock. Instead, let's give them a comedy show. Everybody has a drink. And they've really turned out good, and the responses have been really amazing. So hit us up at Verbal Shenanigans. We could put that together for you. I did one for a company in Tennessee, in New York, in Michigan. So it's been really cool to kind of see how this has expanded a little bit during these times. So hit us up, Verbal Shenanigans. We also run comedy shows. And as far as the podcast, you can check us out on all podcast platforms. I believe we just got added to iHeartRadio, which is pretty cool. We're on Spotify now, Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, BS Podcast Network. There's a lot of places to find us. I want to thank Matt O'Brien for a great interview tonight. That's it, guys. Share the podcast with your friends. Share it with people. And that's it. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
At morning, I will eat cereal. Then later that morning, I will go to my wife and say, "Good morning, honey. I love this morning."